thanks, lovely people. I do loads of talks, but it's always Greenbelt where I'm like, oh no, they're all so intelligent and so thoughtful and good critical analysis. And actually, I've given myself a challenge by doing a new talk because I thought, where's the best place to do it? It's Greenbelt, because they'll give me honest, constructive feedback. So keen for that. So I talk a lot about craftivism, which is what I do full time. So I run a social enterprise, the Craftivist Collective, which is doing activism through craft for the Southerners, craft for the Northerners. Is that better? There's loads of space at the front if anyone wants to sit, but can you hear me? Yes. If I start talking too fast as well, do like a slow down. Your scouse is just merging into one word. So I run the Craftivist Collective. It's a social enterprise that helps people do activism through craft, which is always handicrafts, so using your hands, not machine, not ceramics, not glasswork, always very delicate, small handiwork that's textile-based or paper-based. And it's for people all over the world. So I produce kits like this for people that do it on their own or in groups. And I consult with lots of charities as well on how to do gentle protest, quiet activism, slow activism, how to engage introverts in activism who often don't feel like activism's for them, or burnt out activists back into activism. And also reaching influential audiences in ways that attract them into activism to engage power holders, who those power holders listen to, sadly, more than other audiences. So I do a broad thing around craftivism. But today, for me, writing the book last year, the thing that came out of the book, of the methodology of what I do, was not so much that the craft was the power, but that the gentle approach was the power. And you can do craftivism angry, you can do it really fast, you can throw some craftivism at someone. It doesn't automatically mean that craftivism is gentle. And actually, if you Google it after this talk, you might see that I have a very different approach to some craftivists. So that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the principles behind my activism. Sometimes it's craft, sometimes it's not. My practical examples, just because it's better, isn't it, to have a solid story that you can remember of where it's put into practice. And also just bring it back to that fruit of the spirit of gentleness that isn't something that is just a nice thing to do. I actually think it's more effective most of the time. And some of you in the room might be like, well, hang on a minute, sometimes you need to be angry. And everything's case by case, context by context. But bear that in mind when I'm talking. And if you don't like craft, don't let that close off your mind. I want you to think more about gentleness today than just a bit of cross-stitch, if that's all right. So I've got 3 points, and then we'll hopefully have 20 minutes for questions, because I love questions, and I'm hoping that you've got some. And my 3 points are, I want to talk about gentleness for ourselves, gentleness with power holders, and gentleness with the public when it comes to activism. So they're my 3 categories. And when I'm talking about gentleness, I'm not talking about being passive or weak. I'm talking about being careful. So really carefully thinking about your strategies, thinking about what you're doing, and intentional, and looking at the detail as much as the bigger picture, because we need both in activism, because activism's hard, as you all know in this room. It's not easy, and it's hard to measure and know where you have an impact, and context change so quick. You've got to pivot here, you've got to change stuff here, things come in and out of places that you don't expect, and you've got to really try and look at the detail and the bigger picture at the same time. So I always say activism's a bit of dancing. You've got all the knowledge, but you also need to be flexible and dance around, and it's an art form as much as a science. So it's being careful, it's being compassionate, especially with people you disagree with, especially with those people that you think are causing suffering to people or the planet, which is the hardest, as we know, and Greenbelt's been talking about that. And also being really considerate, like I said, of the context. So everything's different. So being careful, compassionate, and considerate. And as Jude said, I've sort of been an activist since I was 3. Because as a 3-year-old, if your parents are going to go squatting in social housing to save them, you need to go with them, really. I think it would be a little bit of a worry if they left me at home. So they are incredible people. And we won the social housing, just to say, which often you don't. And it's still in West Everton, where I was born and bred. And one of my friends actually lives in one of the family housing there. And the housing was needed because if the houses were knocked down by the local council to build a park that no one wanted, it would have broken up a very close-knit community, very low-income area where you live next to your nan and your uncle. So to break those communities apart with really bad transport in Liverpool anyway would have been disastrous. And to build a park in an area that is got lots of issues and concerns would have made it more unsafe. So it was a very strategic thing to do to keep that social housing. But growing up as an activist, hearing about religion and politics at every meal, involved in local issues, as well as going to South Africa in 91, just after apartheid, with my dad's sabbatical to learn what churches were doing about how to build communities with, you know, after apartheid. I grew up learning where activism works and how it does work, also seeing where it doesn't work and always asking myself, why did that not work there when it did work there? And seeing that not every theory works in practice because of all these different things happening. I ended up being head girl of my school and campaigning for lockers, which we won. Tried to win the eradication of gym knickers in a girls' school that was in the city centre, surrounded by curb crawlers. So that was important to win that campaign, and we lost because we had blockers from teachers. And so I always learned more and more about activism as I grew up. But I'm also an introvert, which means I gain more energy from small groups or on my own. And if you think of activism, it's very extrovert. It's you're with people, you're on a march, you're talking to people, you're mobilising people. So working at Christian Aid and Difford and then Oxfam, I was burning out even though I was really passionate about social change. And not only burning out, I was actually becoming a robotic activist. I was just signing people up to petitions, and if they asked a really thoughtful question, I wasn't thinking, what a great chance to talk about the complexities of climate change and how not just this petition is something to do, but who provides your energy, what you can do locally. I wasn't thinking, what a great opportunity. I was thinking, I don't have time for this. I've got to get more petitions signed. So I also became an angry activist, and I was just reacting to people and screaming at them. And I knew deep down that that wasn't effective, for one. It wasn't loving. And as a Christian, it wasn't what I thought I should be doing. And I didn't think Jesus would be doing that. You know, even when he turned the tables, he made sure the doves weren't in the area. He'd move them. He was very self-controlled. He turned the tables of the coins. He didn't do lots of other stuff. And it was one time. Most of the time, he was very quiet, thoughtful, one-to-one conversations, parables that didn't tell people exactly what to do, which is frustrating for a lot of us here, I think, but provoking people to think about what they can do, what they think the answer is. So I felt like the activism I was doing in my job and in my personal life wasn't gentle and loving, it wasn't careful, it wasn't compassionate. And at the same time, I found Cross Stitch in 2008, which is not something that was cool then. It was really embarrassing. And if I'd bring it out to my friends having food with them in a cafe, they'd be like, put that back in the bag. This is really embarrassing. But I picked up a cross-stitch kit because, like anyone that likes making stuff with their hands, we live in such a digital world that I was getting itchy fingers. I was doing so many emails. I was traveling all over the country trying to help people become effective activists. But I wanted to slow down, and I wanted to make things as well, just for fun. I never picked up cross stitch thinking I'll use this in activism. And actually, some of the craft lovers in the room, I challenge you and say, if you want to shoehorn your craft into activism, I'm going to flip that on its head and say, don't ever do that. The activism has to come first. But there's a few elements within, nice little spider on my microphone. There's a few elements in the making that, for us as activists, I think are amazing because of the gentleness. So with craft, like cross-stitch or hand embroidery, when you separate the thread, you have to do it slowly. You can't do it really fast, otherwise it breaks or it creates a knot. So when I started doing that, I immediately noticed that I had to slow down. I was so used to emailing, typing and responding and reacting, because activists, we react all the time. I noticed I had shaky hands. I noticed that my shoulders were really tight when I was trying to separate the thread. I noticed I had really shallow breath. So I was very aware as my body, I was completely burning out. And while I was cross-stitching, it was such a comforting, repetitive thing. So it's very meditative. So anyone that you know that does handicraft, they'll often say it takes them away from the world and it calms them down. It's good for anxiety. It's good for self-harm. It's good for, it's healthy for everyone, whether you like craft or not. There's prisoners in Wandsworth Prison, men who find so much, it helps them so much on their rehabilitation just doing craft. But it created this safe space for me to slow down, calm down, do on my own, and then ask myself really difficult questions like, am I being a good activist? Am I being robotic? Am I actually doing so much activism to make me feel like I'm doing something good rather than making the time to see whether I'm just doing things as an excuse not to really look at what I'm doing strategically or not, which I think I was doing more of that than the angry stuff. So it really, I used that comfort of craft to ask myself difficult questions. And I was really annoyed actually with the charity sector. Sorry, because I work with a lot of you. But I thought, why have we never offered people a form of slow activism to really grapple with these big, complex issues that often are intertwined with other issues, where most of the time there isn't a clear person that's at fault and a clear way to win. I wanted to look at it holistically and go, okay, well, what can I do on climate justice? Yes, I can change my light bulbs, but I could do more than that, couldn't I? Yes, I could sign that petition, but what else? I was never really offered that space as an individual by other activists to say, let's slow down, let's reflect, and let's see what we can do with our circle of influence, with the time that we're at. Can we be as strategic as possible? We were just reacting as quick as possible, or we were told by very intelligent charities, we've done all that for you, so you don't need to think, because we know you're busy, just do this. And for an introvert, I needed to slow down as well and reflect. And the other thing with the gentleness for ourselves was that I also felt like what was lacking in the activism toolkit, because I always say that craftivism is part of the toolkit, not to replace other forms. But that gentleness that I missed in activism was those conversations with people that you might disagree with people that come from different perspectives. But when I joined lots of activist groups, which I had for many years, I always felt really nervous to ask a question because I was nervous of eye contact with people. I prefer looking at a table. I was scared in case I was saying something against someone, so it was very combative, and I'm not good with conflict. And I needed a bit of time to reflect to then respond rather than to ask a question and have a response straight back at me and for me to then get aggressive or go into fight or flight mode, which is what most of us do. We either fight back or we fly away and hide away. So I wanted a space where people could ask difficult questions, could reflect, could not make a sound if they didn't want to, and not be seen as someone that isn't committed to the cause. It's just someone who might be a bit quieter and need time to reflect. I wanted also somewhere where people that talk the most can realize that they might need to shut up a little bit, but without us telling them that. And again, with craft, so because of the handicraft, that lack of eye contact when you're in a group is gold dust, and that's for anyone, whether you're an extrovert, introvert, super confident or anxious. I have it where I'm around tables. This is the gentleness part of it, is we have workshops where we have instrumental music, so there's no awkward silence when you walk in the room. I worked with a music psychologist to make sure it wasn't distracting music, but it actually helped with creating those crafter thoughts, which I call as the critical thinking. We have flowers on the table because there's lots of evidence around how if you have a plant or fruit or something living on the table, then without us even realizing, we tap into our intrinsic values much more than our extrinsic values. So you are much more engaged in the world, in communion. I have grapes on the table, so people share food, which is especially good with people who've come from all different backgrounds. We need to share and it breaks the ice. I make sure that even if I've got enough scissors for the group, I always make people share and I hide the extras so they don't see them. So it takes away any hierarchy. And I've been doing craftivism nearly 10 years now, and I'm always honing my craft in activism as well as in all of the gentle and psychology elements. And one example is in Stockholm a few years ago, when I wanted to be here, I was in Stockholm doing an exhibition and workshops and talks for 5 weeks. And one workshop I had a very, and she'll let me say this because it's in the book, there was a woman called Jess, who's a mum of a small daughter, and she came to one workshop very angry, very, you know, held her ground, quite... She intimidated me massively. She looked at me as if to say, what is this fluffy stuff that I'm going to be doing now? And she sat next to another woman who worked very high up in the Swedish embassy. And they sat next to each other and I thought, oh, this could go really badly. But we've got the flowers, we've got yellow fabric on the table because it's a hopeful colour. It's a little bit orangey, which means it's more action orientated than a bluey yellow. But there's no red or black anywhere, so it's not aggressive. This is the gentle, sneaky bits that I'm talking about, the carefulness and consideration. They sat near each other and Jess, the anarchist mother, knew how to craft. But the other lady, Jenny, didn't. So when you find someone struggling on something that you're working on, they'd never even spoken before. And I'm lucky as a facilitator, I get to watch all of this without them knowing. So Jess helped Jenny thread her needle, show her what to do. And it took away some tension because they looked very different as to each other. And so there was a little bit of the other happening, I think. And Jess has told me that. So I feel like I can say that to you guys. But because they were Jess was helping, Jenny could then say, tell me a bit about your anarchy then. Well, how have you got to that point? And because they didn't need to give eye contact, Jess could explain it while she has the comfort of craft, because she's quite an aggressive person. She could explain it nice and slowly without eye contact. And then Jenny could say, okay, tell me more about that. And then Jess, who is quite stubborn, was like, so how does an embassy even work? And they could have these conversations. And then what I do, because you could have a craft group and talk about anything, but I make sure we have these craft of thought questions in all of the kits for people to reflect on, for each kit that's different, and make sure that they're challenging questions. So if it's about inner activism, like our footprint kit is, you make yourself a physical stitch footprint to keep as a physical reminder to think about what journey you're on as a global citizen, what steps are you taking each day, try and live intentionally. And it's a bit like, you know, religions have objects to remind us to be good believers and good followers. Activists don't tend to have something to keep them accountable, so we make these footprints. So they were stitching them, and it meant that they could have these conversations about, well, what are you doing? Well, what am I doing? So it was a very holistic workshop, but some of them are more specific. But I really push people to look at their craft of thoughts. So it's gentle, but it's challenging. All of my stuff is lovingly challenging because at the end of the day, it's about protest. It's not about fundraising or donation or just awareness raising. This is about what structures and systems are stopping the world fulfilling its potential and people fulfilling its potential. And what do we need to protest against? But always having that vision of what we want the world to be and focusing on that so that we can stop these things rather than just going no to this, no to that. So that's the gentleness for ourselves. Is it made it more sustainable for me because I slowed down, I was mindful, I was very critical of what I was doing, but in a comforting space where I didn't make myself feel awful about myself. And while you're stitching, with every stitch, you're achieving something. So even if you're bad at stitching, you're like, I've just done a stitch. If I can do that, maybe I could do this thing. So it actually makes you much more empowered because you're using your hands with your head and your heart. Whereas if you're just focusing on your heart being so upset by injustice, or you're so heady on what do I need to do, you can burn out quite easily. So the gentleness is not letting yourself off the hook, but it's lovingly challenging yourself and others to do activism in this gentle way, which I think then does make us more effective. You with me? Is this making sense? Whew. Okay. I normally don't have notes, so now I'm looking at notes, a bit nervous. Okay, so the next one is gentleness with power holders. And this is where I get loads of tweets from people going, how dare you encourage a power holder? We need to get rid of them, topple them, and get someone else in. I'm a big geek, so I read lots of reports. I'm freelance now, but I still have sneaky people in Oxfam that send me reports that they've paid for, that they let me read, which I love. And there's a lot around power holders of they're human beings, and we know this is common sense. They're human beings. Most of the time, they're not aiming to do evil stuff. They might have a belief system that's a bit skewed. They might have something that's happened to them in the past that's led them on one tunnel vision track, and they're struggling to find other ways of doing things. Most harm that happens in the world from humans is because they're hurting themselves in some way. Most people who are stable and love themselves don't tend to do lots of harmful things. And a lot of harm that happens comes from people not realizing that they're part of the chain, which all of us are part of the chain. So I was really frustrated with activism that just demonized power holders, screamed at them, told them what to do rather than asked them whether they had any knowledge on their job that they'd been doing for 30 years that they might be able to engage with. It was very transactional, and it wasn't gentle. It wasn't loving. It was treating them as the other, which is what we've been talking about, the green belt, not looking at their face, not seeing them as human, made us feel better in the short term, but not the long term. So I wanted a way to engage power holders as critical friends rather than aggressive enemies. And again, using something very delicate that uses all the senses, so not just the language of positivity. So I never, in all of my work, whether it's craft or just activism, I never use against or fight or them. It's always very inclusive language about encouraging. It's always very positive. And language is just as important as colours and fonts and all of that, which you know. So one example to share with you is that I worked with Share Action, who are heavily involved with Citizens UK. If anyone knows Share Action, they do shareholder activism. And I had the CEO, who's an incredible woman, Catherine Howarth, who's one of my sheroes and have a massive campaign crush on her, which is a little bit embarrassing. But we're friends now, so it's fine. And she emailed me saying, I've got your weird little book and I've just read it and it's so weird. And we've been trying to get a large retail company to pay the living wage for 3 years, and we've had no success. We've had no meetings. We haven't even been able to speak to them one-to-one and get in the same room as them. And we don't know what's happening. And I think your stuff is so odd that I might as well ask you to do something. Which is a nice compliment in some ways. I had 5 weeks before the AGM where she told me this. So I thought, okay, well, what are we gonna do? So they're not listening. The CEO is completely ignoring. I Googled him a bit and thought, yeah, he is not budging on this issue at all. They tried everything. So I thought, well, who's above the CEO? Well, it's the board. The board members are, the CEO is accountable to the board members. So I looked at their company and I saw, who do they listen to? They listen not, sadly, they might not. They've already done stuff where people who directly don't have the living wage in that company, they weren't listening to that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to target the people that are their core audience, who happen to be mostly, in a crude way, but what the evidence we saw was white middle-class women who buy for their families and will be a long-term supporter of their company and a loyal customer. So I looked across the UK, so it wasn't London-centric where I'm based, picked 14 craftivists and also 5 craftivists to engage with 5 of their celebrity models in their last advertising campaign, and 5 craftivists to give a gift to the 5 chief financial officers of the biggest investor companies in that company, because they're going to listen to those investor companies more than me, and they'll listen to their customers more than me. And I said, I want you to Google this board member I've gave you. And beforehand, I'd looked at who the board members were and who I thought had similarities with these, I call them hardcore craftivists, which makes them sound scary. They're just committed, geeky, good ones that could rely on. And I said, Google everything about them, from what colour they were to what their hobbies are, look on LinkedIn at what their jobs have been in the past, whether they're a trustee for something else to see what they're passionate about, whether they come across shy and introverted or very loud and flamboyant, try and figure out what makes them tick as a human being, and then embroider a handkerchief that we had bought from that shop to show that we were customers, not boycotters. And I gave them all their handkerchiefs and posted to them. And I gave them craft of thought questions to read while they were stitching for hours. And on every handkerchief we said a quote that we thought that person would engage with. So my board member was quite a quiet woman, but highly had done amazing stuff in business. And she wore lots of purple, as lots of women do. So I had a purple dotted handkerchief for hair from like from the company that she's a board member for. And I stitched a quote from Rosa Parks on it, which I should have written down and I forgot, but you can find it on our website. I put a quote on there thinking Rosa Parks was an amazing woman and quiet and introverted and did what she had to do, but didn't want to stand up. And this woman's quite similar, I think. So I'm going to stitch this message on. I'm going to do it in a beautiful way that's attractive rather than intimidating. And we're going to put them all in boxes. Some of the handkerchiefs had flowers on because a board member was a trustee of Kew Gardens. One had music notes on with a quote from a musician about social change because he was involved in the Royal Opera House. So we tried to make our craft about them. So it's a very humble form of activism where we knew we didn't have the power, they had the power. And how can we engage them to encourage them and say, don't blow it. Use your power for good. We know this is a tough job, but I want this little object to encourage you in what you can do. And it was never demonizing or transactional. It was very much saying, we don't think you're awful people. We actually are presuming you're probably lovely people, but you might be busy. You've clearly got lots of pressure from your shareholders. And I became a shareholder so I could go to the AGM, and you hear all of these questions saying, why haven't I got more money? Why aren't you like these fast fashion cheap companies making loads of profit? And the board are sitting there like, oh man. So really about empathizing with the power holder whilst making stuff for them, putting yourself in their shoes, which could be really difficult if they're a different power holder, and challenging yourself, challenging your preconceptions, challenging the presumptions you might have about them, challenging whether you hate them or whether you're showing love while you're stitching them. And then we wrapped them up in little boxes. We wrote handwritten letters with them saying, I was stitching your hanky for hours and I was thinking about you and your job, and I was thinking about people that work for you who I love because I love your company, and about how if I was on the minimum wage in this world we're living in now, it would be bloody tough. So it would be brilliant if you became a living wage employer. You're so influential in the retail space with low-end retail as well as high-end. If you change the way and pioneer the way in the living wage, you'll have ripple effects. And wouldn't that be brilliant? So it was still humble, but it was encouraging. And we hand-delivered them, so not throwing them in their face. We did it quite embarrassingly at the end of the AGM because we were all quite shy people that you don't expect to be the activists, and we're like, we've made you these. I'm so over. I hope you like them. And half of them got them before, and half of them, because the staff members wanted to get them all to give them before the AGM for some reason. I think they thought there might be something scary in them. And afterwards, the chair of the board had a good conversation with us. All of them, we spoke to them one-to-one, so very gentle. We haven't shared what those board members told us in confidence because we'd lose their trust. But we understood what made them all tick. We had a little huddle at the end. So before that, I said to all the craftivists, when you hand it over, make sure you do it with a smile. Make sure you go in with an open question and not a demand or a statement. Say, I've made you this, I really hope you can think about it and have a think, and I hope it encourages you in your role. And then we found out from them what their thoughts were. And quite quickly, we're quite savvy human beings. You could tell from body language, from the way people spoke. We huddled at the end, figured out who were the blockers, who were just like, I'm not listening, making excuses that we just thought, maybe we can't change their mind. We figured out who were the allies who quietly told us stuff. And also who were the ones that might actually be even stronger allies. So we got so much intel from giving gifts in gentle, thoughtful ways that are small and not big and brash, that really helped our campaign. And for 14 months, then we did no craft, annoyingly. We just had boring meetings with them. We had quiet, boring meetings. We didn't tell people that we were having these meetings. We fed in all the information that they needed, but we always started with, we're going to presume, whether it's right or wrong, we're going to presume that they want to be lovely human beings and pay the living wage, and we're going to feed everything in. And after 14 months, the chair of the board had announced that 50,000 of their lowest paid staff were going to get the living wage, which was incredible. Thank you. Sadly, they're not accredited living wage employers, so we're still campaigning on that. But he also spoke to me at other meetings very quietly, saying that without your hankies, this wouldn't have been on our agenda. It wasn't on our agenda at all, but we were so moved by them. And you had all the evidence there to say this is good for business as well, which was important for us to read. But it really stuck with us, and you all seem nice. And if you were out, and he said this word for word, if you were outside shouting at us, we wouldn't be speaking to you. And I thought, this is where gentleness can work. We need lots of forms of activism, but if we can be gentle, I think we should start there. If we have to be more aggressive as a last term option, then possibly, but where possible, I think we can be gentle and thoughtful and considered, but still make them accountable. And it really did have an impact, and it built us relationships with them. And I think that if we didn't do it quietly, we also made sure that when they announced it, we didn't claim the win for ourselves. We said, well done to this company. You've got a little bit to go with accreditation, but this is brilliant. So proud. We love your company. We're going to shop more in your company. We want accreditation, so we're not going to let you off the hook, but well done. We never claimed the win for ourselves, because we would have lost that trust with them and that relationship with them, just like you would with a mate. If your mate changes your mind and you start celebrating, changes the whole dynamic, doesn't it? And then the third one is that I felt like, as an introvert who's actually quite hypersensitive, which some introverts are, I'm one of those annoying people that even when you're... My mum's not as bad as she used to be, but she used to send me text in capital letters. And I literally would wince, because it would be like she's shouting at me, and it's only a little text, but I get really tired. I get overwhelmed by lots of shouting or big images or exclamation marks. I go into the flight mode rather than the fight mode. And a lot of people are like that. We're all across the spectrum. We're all stubborn human beings that don't really like to be told what to do, even if we know it's right. We want to figure it out ourselves. And I felt like what was on offer in activism for the public, to engage the public, was giant posters in capital letters saying, no to this, do that. It's very patronizing. It was very stunting your thought process, because it was just do this, do that, not what do you think about this, let's ask a question about that, what would you do. It was all very sharp and aggressive and angry and loud, whether it was the volume or whether it was the text itself, and quite ugly. And I was desperately trying to make my friends into activists, but I was being put off by it, and I care about these issues. So I really struggled to engage them. And a lot of my friends were not activists, and in some ways aren't your typical activists. So I really wanted to engage them, because they're loving, thoughtful people that want to make the world a better place as well, but didn't think activism was for them. And I thought, if you look at advertising across the world, how do we get people to do stuff? Well, we entice them, we attract them. We say how good it is for people and how good it is for the world. But in activism, we weren't doing that. We were doing it very aggressive, hard, quick. So the other thing that I wanted to grapple with was how to attract people in that gentle, considered, careful way, and in a way that put the onus on them to say, I actually think you've got a brain on that body, so I think you could come up with it yourself rather than me tell you what to do. So I wanted activism to be into places where you don't normally expect it. And the first project I came up with were these little mini cross-stitched banners. And cross-stitch is good because, especially nowadays, maybe not in the younger generation, sadly, but it often reminds us of our grandmothers or our mothers, or it's a very kitsch aesthetic, which is naturally non-threatening. I use everything as lowercase. My little banners would say a provocative question or a fact, but not tell you what to think, and it would be put somewhere relevant to the issue. So it might be a fact about how much garment workers are paid compared to models in London Fashion Week, and I'd put it inside Somerset House, because who are the influencers within the retail, within fashion? It's all these people at Somerset House during London Fashion Week. The models, the bloggers, the Instagrammers, the fashionistas, the buyers for companies. And I always hang them low, below eye level, rather than above. So not in your face saying, look at me, look at me. And there's lots of psychology of if you put something lower, again, it's more humble. But also people naturally look down if they're not looking at their phone, which is annoying now. People didn't always look at their phone when I started doing it. Instagram and Pinterest did not exist when I started doing craftivism. It blows my mind. So people would spot it, and because it was small and there was text, so it was clear it was a social injustice, it wasn't too ambiguous that you think, I don't know what this is, and it was still challenging people to think, people would choose to go up to it because they'd decide to read the text. In a split second, you wouldn't normally go, I'm going to decide to read this text and go up. You would just do it, which meant that naturally you were more open-hearted and open-minded and intrigued. So you'd read it. Sometimes you'd have to reread it and reread it again to say, what's this actually telling me? Where am I here? How has someone spent hours making this and it's anonymous and they've just left it up? This is really interesting. And it would be thinking about that issue. So whether it's how extreme capitalism is not helping anyone, I'd say that in a nicer way, and we put it in the banking district, or if it was about climate change and you put it somewhere with lots of cement where it's a very different environment to what you want. So just to plant those little seeds and let people think for themselves. So not to say, here's an issue, this is what I'm asking you to do, now go do it, thanks a lot, move on, tell the next person. It was planting these little seeds to let people think for themselves. And people started wanting to do them themselves around the world, and people would share them online because it wasn't too negative that you felt like your friends' eyes would roll if you shared it. Because it was intriguing and beautiful and hopeful and attractive, people were much more likely to share it and have difficult conversations with their friends because this gave them an excuse to do it. And another one, so it was very much about provoking, not preaching, and attracting people rather than attacking them. And another example is I get people around the world to make these mini scrolls, and they're on lovely dimpled paper. So if you think about the senses, if we engage two or more senses, we're more likely to remember things. It's good for us all to know. So some people doodle because it helps them listen to a talk, or knit, or if there's smells in a room, you're more likely to remember what you were doing at that time. So I always use two senses or more. It's got little embossed scissors, like my arm tattoo, so there's something you want to touch. And it says on it, in my neatest writing that I think my primary school teacher would be impressed by, it says, please open me with a smiley face and a little kiss. So as non-aggressive as possible, as intriguing as possible, with pretty ribbon that's more luxurious, purple and turquoises. Naturally in our minds are seen more as luxurious than other colours like a standard green, because it actually cost more to make these colours together. And you have to interact with it. So because you, again, have chosen to open it, you've chosen to interact with it, your hands are actually doing something and not just tapping on a screen. We shop drop them in unethical fashion shops. Instead of shoplifting, you shop drop them in little pockets, just one in a shirt pocket or in a bag. And then people find them and they go, oh, please open me. This is a bit weird. And it'll say one of three messages, and you, as the maker, handwrite it. And while you're handwriting it or stitching something, you really do take ownership of what you've made. Otherwise, you're not going to spend the time doing it. And I ask people to write it very slowly and neatly so the viewer can see someone's put time into it. And it'll say a message like, if your clothes could talk, ... what tales might they tell? Stories of how they were made with love, joy, and care, or sadness, tragedy, and heartbreak. What would your clothes say to you? And then at the bottom, it has a little @FashRev so that people don't just go, I don't know what to do with that. That's too much. You've overwhelmed me. You've actually disempowered me because I don't know what to do about this. It's got @FatRev, so you can Google it. Even if you're not on Twitter, you can Google it. It's Fashion Revolution, which is an incredible fashion campaign organization that I think are doing brilliant work in a very gentle, positive way. And you can find more information about finding out who did make your clothes. Or you can ask the shop manager, who made my clothes? Or you can tweet a picture of your clothes directly to the company. And it has a real big ripple effect. It's a very strategic way of campaigning. And just by shop dropping these little gentle, small, lowercase, handwritten scrolls is one way of engaging people to make them be curious, make them realize that I don't think they're stupid. I think you're really clever. And I think you could probably Google this stuff and find out what's going on. And you'd enjoy it. Because once you find out who made your clothes, you can find out who makes even better clothes. And then when your friend says, oh, I like your dress, you can say, well, it's made in the EU and there's not too much fast fashion. And I know I've seen the picture of the woman that made it. Or you can say, I can't afford anything apart from fast fashion, so I'm going to ask the companies to do what they should be doing and keep the prices low, which they can, and which Fashion Revolution acknowledge, and see what you can do. But it's very much putting the onus on the public rather than preaching at them and trying to attract them, never judging them, never labeling them, never presuming anything negative about people, but trying to really say, I think you're brilliant. I think you could probably even be more brilliant because we all can. And let's all be part of the solution and not the problem where we can. But the onus isn't all on you to save the world on your own. There's loads of people out there, whether you're introvert or extrovert, you've all got different skills and talents. And that's what I try and do in my protest, is make it as gentle as possible for yourself so you don't burn out, but thoughtful. For when you're engaging with these power holders, whether it's a local MP or whether it's a CEO of a company, and also just in the public sphere, you know, this is a lovely, I'd love the world to be like Greenbelt, but sadly it's not. And to scream at people with placards is not always helpful. As I think there's other ways we can plant gentle little seeds. And I think someone told me Charles talked about golden seeds. You know, let's plant these little golden seeds to say, the world's not as great as it could be. We can make it into this gorgeous place. Here's an example of beauty in the world. And if we want the world to be more beautiful, kind and just, let's make our activism beautiful, kind and just. Don't you reckon? Thanks, I'm done.
Thank you.
I'm sweating.
It's very warm, isn't it?
I'm going to say it's the weather. I think it's the nervousness a little bit as well.
Have you got time to take some questions?
I'd love some questions. And I like difficult questions, so don't tiptoe around me.
Okay, who thinks they've got the hardest question? Oh, that gentleman there.
Thanks. Agreed with so much of that. Inspirational.
Thank
Last
you.
Year, some of us may remember, we had Bill McKibben here of 350.org, who said that the mistake he made was that for 25 years he treated his debate with the fossil fuel companies as a debate, as an argument. In retrospect, it was a mistake. Yeah. He said all along we were in a fight. Are there any areas of conflict between, you know, us and the power elite, if you like, which are uncompromisingly a fight, do you think, and where your approach probably wouldn't do very much?
Like I said at the beginning, everything's case by case, everything's context. I think we need to be much cleverer and not seeing this big company that we've got to turn, but go, who's in the company? So something I'm really interested in at the moment is, who are the directors of HR in these companies? There's a HR charter that is like a mission statement for HR people to say you should be treating your staff well, you should be making sure that you're not being irresponsible. People are targeting them. So I'd break it all down and say, first of all, before you even think about being violent, try as much as possible not to, and not see it as a fight, but see it as, where are the allies? Why aren't... So I just did a big thing, which was ridiculous. It was 48-hour like campaign hackathon thing, which I nearly vomited at the end. I was so exhausted. It was not good. But it was Cristina Figueres from the Climate Change UN facilitator who got 40 of us together and said, how do we work? It's not working what we're doing against the cement industry, for example. The cement industry you could see as the enemy because cement is a massive polluter and they're not budging on anything. But they're not budging on anything because we're not saying, giving them clear solutions. We're saying, Google are doing clean energy stuff, why can't you? Well, it's a cement company. I mean, bloody hell, that's difficult for them to do stuff. And if you speak to them one-to-one, so I haven't, but people within the room had, and they were saying, we know you see us as the dirty energy people, and I hate that. And I struggle to sleep, I struggle to go home and look in my kids' eyes, but you're not giving us solutions, you're not giving us subsidies to change our ways, you're not encouraging us, you're seeing us as us and them. He didn't say those words, they're Greenbelt words, obviously. But he was there, and I thought, why isn't he in this room? That was my flag to the hackathon thing. This cement guy should be here, because he wants this solution just as much as the rest. There's definitely one thing that doesn't work is with psychopaths, sadly, which is a small percentage of the world, but you can't do a lot in terms of emotion and engagement with psychopaths, because they're just different species, and there's lots of evidence around how their brain works. But stuff like people will talk about Trump, you can't get in anywhere. Well, what has made him think this way? He's hurting in some way. Who listens to him? Who does he listen to? Where can we work around him sometimes? So with this company, we had a very clear blocker that we thought we needed to engage. We just went around him. So I still don't, and I look throughout history at different campaigns, I still think that there are weird, lateral, odd ways to never see it as a fight. But you sometimes have to go through quite a lot of people to find the allies. Sometimes you need to ignore that company and get all the other companies involved so that that company then goes, oh, either the public see us as bad or my peers see me as bad. So a lot of people will do stuff because they want to look good to their peers rather than, you know, whether it's healthy energy or not. But I'd want to know your case studies to say which exact ones you have to fight, which ones you can work around, but also being aware that you need every different angle. So good example is Greenpeace will do really big shocking facts to get something in the media straight away, but they will tell Friends of the Earth, who've got good relationships with business leaders and politicians they work with for years, they'll tell them in advance to say, we're going to piss off this person, so we're going to tell you in advance so that you can then speak to that person who you've got contact with. So there's some little things like that, but so far I've never had to see someone as an enemy. I've always tried to see them as a human being, maybe not a friend.
That company was obviously saying it was quite interesting.
Which one?
Concrete, set in its ways.
I'm a bit slow. But it's worth knowing, if you know anyone, so I've got friends that work for dirty companies, and one of them went to church recently, she hadn't been for years, and at the back of her church was a guy getting people to sign petitions against the big dirty company she works for. She works quite high up there now. And he was saying, you've got to sign this because these are evil companies doing evil things, and as Christians, we need to not do this. And she cried because she works for that company and she hasn't gone back to church. And she called me up and said, is this what you think of me? And I had to go through with it, a bit like we were talking today, of where you're in this company. Someone was mentioned sometimes you might need to leave the job and go somewhere else. In the position she's in, she could have loads of influence in really good ways. And you need good people in bad companies as well. And not just everyone on the outside of the gate whacking the door. You need people on the inside as well. You need people who talk to their mums who are high up in the business, or their nephew who might be a powerful person. You need it coming from everywhere, I think, rather than narrow. Sorry. Hello.
Hello, I'm just qualified as a nurse. And one of the things that I've found is that in the NHS, there's a lot of division between us and them.
Yeah.
And in terms of the Health and Social Care Act, they've been trying to try and integrate health and social care. And there's been a lot of new policy that's been brought in to try and merge it. And nurses have got a bit of a reputation for being quite quiet and just getting on with their jobs and desperately trying to care for their patients.
Yeah.
And I'm only a baby nurse, but I was just wondering, I'm not an activist really, but you want to see change, and you know, even though you're caring for patients, and our role is very much like one-on-one with patients, mm-hmm. we're within a structure where you know that there's got to be change at a different level.
Yeah.
But you're at the grassroots, yeah. So we have power.
Yeah.
We're a point of contact for so many people. Mm. So I was just wondering whether you've got any tips about how you gently go about trying to make change and trying to connect people where...
Yeah.
There's always that division between different services and
and trying to do it while you also have a demanding full-time job.
Yeah.
It's probably emotionally and physically exhausting.
Yeah.
And it's hard with stuff that's really, you desperately want to change it now. And, you know, so much campaigning takes years. Sometimes you don't see the impact. And I always tell people to start with their circle of influence rather than their passion, which is often a bit topsy-turvy. Sometimes you start with, what are you passionate about? And then go do it. So for you to be, I was talking this morning about being a healthy activist, which is difficult for all of us, and I burn out sometimes, but I've learned to help people not burn out. And it's looking at, well, what can you actually do? So can you have those lovely conversations with people, and when they say, how are you doing, your patients, you say, oh, I'm a bit knackered, you know, all of these pressures of this changing system, like, I'm really worried that I'm not giving you the care you need, and other people like you, I don't really know what I'm doing, you know. It's the Brené Brown power of vulnerability stuff, and that honesty. And then, and you'll know with the patient whether you need to back away and whether they're like, oh, I've voted against this, or I don't agree with you. But you're planting those seeds. They know you're trying your best, but you're struggling. But also looking at your circle of influence, going, what can I do? Can I join a particular group, or can I feed in my testimonies to the local paper? You know, be clear on what you can actually do and not beat yourself up about stuff you can't. As a, I know not everyone's a Christian here, but as a Christian, for me, I always have to remember that there's always going to be poverty in the world, even though my whole being wants to be like, no, we will fix it all and it'll be fine. So also, what's possible and what's not, and just keeping it in conversation, but in general ways that it's just part of a natural conversation of, oh, I'm worried about this, but how are you doing? So you've put it in them, but they're, you know, if they're on a bed, it's not fair for them for you to have a rant at them if they're unwell and can't move. So I think it's the honesty, but planting stuff. And then I always go to charities and say, what can I do within what I've got, rather than feel like I've got to create a whole new thing myself. See yourself as a piece of the jigsaw puzzle rather than the whole puzzle. But always remember to make time to enjoy the gorgeousness of life, but strive for it to be better. But yeah, there's no easy, quick answer for that, but there's some little elements.
Yeah, craft. Sorry, that's about right. Craft is obviously a brilliant vessel for this, but have you got any positive suggestions and ideas for somebody like myself who probably couldn't thread the needle? It's not just because I'm a bloke. Anything I do crafty always looks like it's been done by a five-year-old.
Yeah.
Any other ways of making gifts that could be helpful and get that key in, as you've been talking about?
Yeah, so first thing to say to you, sir, is I've never had a man that hasn't been able to do my workshop, so you got no excuse unless you've got a physical disability. And often it's people who've never crafted before who are more open to the craftivism as not craft, going, yeah, I know what to do, but going, okay, I'm going to do this carefully and look through the questions. I'm passionate about activism, not craft. I started doing cross-stitch stuff because I was getting travel sick on trains, so I couldn't paint watercolours. And I never went into it going, I'm going to use this for activism. I noticed things that helped. And over the years of doing craftivism, I've gone a bit into papercraft for one thing and different styles. But it comes back to craft because it is quite unique, because of the hand, heart and heads, because of the repetitive action, because it's soft and small, so it calms people down, because of the lack of eye contact, because of the aesthetics of the history behind it for people that see it, because it's delicate and frayed around the edges. So part of me is worried that no one will read the book who doesn't love craft, because I think there's so much in there that is transferable. But also, I don't care if you don't like craft. If it works as an activism tool, you use it. Just like lots of the time I won't do craft. I'll go on a march if that's the best thing to do. I'll have lots of boring meetings where there's no creativity involved if that's the best thing to do. So I don't want people to think that they have to like craft. And often it's the people that like craft that don't get the fullness out of craftivism, because they bring their own stuff into it, or they use it as an excuse to say, I'm doing stuff, look, I'm gonna make lots of blankets for the homeless. And so I think you're in a really good position to actually do the gentle, careful craftivism and see what works. But also, I just did a virtual school of gentle protest, which is 6 weeks, 6 videos with homework. and there's only one craft element in it. The rest is me talking to different experts about the art of conversation. So someone that says something really harmful, xenophobic or something, and how do you offer open, loving questions to challenge them rather than beat them down or run away? So I won't use craft if someone says something about all politicians are corrupt. I'll go, hang, you know, if it's the right person, I'll go, hang on a minute, all of them. Was Joe Cox, was she? And we'll have a giggle. Or if it's someone else, I'll go, whoa, that's a big statement. Do you know every single one? Or, ooh, that sounds a bit harmful. Let's not say that. You know for the different people what to do. So there's probably less than half of what I do is craft related because, like I said throughout this, it's the craft of thought questions to think about, how to have these conversations, how to offer your gift in a humble way rather than an aggressive, competing for power way. So I do want everyone to see craftivism as a useful tool in some places within their activism strategies and not just see it as something I've got to like craft. I wear mostly monochrome. I do not wear these types of colours. I know kitsch colours works for the type of work I'm doing, but this isn't my aesthetic. If you look at my little flat, I got nothing that looks like this.
Sarah,
does that answer your question? Yeah.
I know I'm the compere, but I'd like to ask the last question.
Selfish! Yes,
I know. My last question is this. Is there a way which we could show you our appreciation that isn't in the loud, shouty, clappy way that we usually show our appreciation? Because it might be nice to do something different to you that also shows we could use the sign language.
Oh,
would that be all right?
That would be lovely.
Let us show you our appreciation because it's been a fabulous session. Thank you.
Thanks. And thank you so much for being so lovely. It's a bit scary being here in front of Green Belters.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.